Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Karwoski.
This is Jane Karwoski, along with my co-host Jim Nico. I'm an experimental psychologist, Dr. J, and the chief science officer of our parent company, Social Network Intermedia, LLC, of which Jim is the founder and CEO. Today, you will meet the author of The Electronic Silk Road, How the Web Binds the World in Commerce. You've heard us discuss business aspects of social numerous times, but we have not discussed trade per se with you before, and that is what Professor Anupam Chander focuses on. He is an international law expert, and today we'll take you into the questions of how the borderless nature of the World Wide Web is challenging the regulation of global commerce. Professor Chander graduated from Harvard University in economics, magna cum laude, and law school of Yale. He is the professor of law at University of California, Davis, and has been a visiting professor at the law schools of the University of Chicago, Yale, Stanford, and Cornell. He is the director of the California International Law Center at UC Davis. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Professor Chander.
Thanks very much for having me, Dr. J.
Thank you very much, and thank you for writing this brilliant book, which we're going to be talking about.
Thank you.
You know, maybe first you could tell us just a bit about the ancient Silk Road and why it's an apt comparison.
Well, one of the things that the ancient Silk Road did was to connect civilizations. It powered commerce and knowledge during that time, for a millennia, essentially, for a millennium, I should say. So what we're seeing today is something similar. We have this kind of the rise of cyberspace connecting people all over the world and making possible kind of information transfer, knowledge transfer, and also commerce across the world.
And the commerce, of course, with the Silk Road, it required physical movement of objects or goods. It was a trading of goods.
Right.
Whereas today, even though the trade of goods is often facilitated by the internet, what you focus on is the actual trade of services over the internet, correct?
Exactly. So, for human history and during the time of the Silk Road, people really thought that services were not tradable. That you couldn't actually trade services across borders. That you could just travel to provide a service. Get on the road and show up as an itinerant craftsperson. Buildings like the Taj Mahal were built with artisans from around the world.
Mm.
And so that was the way we did trade in services before people actually got on the road. And now, of course, people can provide services across the world. Your show is being hosted out of Las Vegas. I'm sitting in California. Your listeners could be anywhere in the world, and they likely are. And we could all be traveling and still produce this kind of exciting show. And so that's the world that we've come to, a world where people can provide many kinds of services, information services, from wherever they are. And it turns out that a lot of what we do is really providing information services. Even companies that do manufacturing, a lot of the work that behind the scenes is doing information services. So even those companies are being transformed by this new internet age.
Such as the design and...
Exactly, design. But not only that, but human resources management, all the publicity and advertising, and everything that goes into the processes of even the old line manufacturing companies involves typically people providing information services. And so there are, of course, the people who are working with their hands, and those people need to be in a physical place that, assembles or produces the goods. But information services are being splintered and spread across the world.
And also in perspective on this, the aspect that Google Translate, for example, I remember when I was making a feeble attempt to reach other languages, other cultures, and I used to go put in these sentences in Google Translate and send them out via Twitter. It was fascinating how many people actually responded, you know.
Right.
And now, you know, and I wasn't good at it at all, but it's like, wow. So you can do that instantaneous transfer.
Right. And before, you might have actually so let's think about what Google Translate is. It turns out that if you think about it, it actually is a service. And you can imagine someone doing that before the rise of Google. You'd pay someone to translate this sentence for you, these characters, this tweet for you.
Mm-hmm.
That would cost money, and you could maybe hire someone across the world, et cetera. But now we have these information services that are provided by these automated systems. And often because they're free, we don't think of them as a part of international commerce. And of course, they are part of international commerce because they're part of an ecosystem of services that that Google provides, that Facebook provide, that enable you to live your life better and provide you information that you need on a daily basis, and that are part of a system of commerce where Google and Facebook ultimately end up making, you know, billions of dollars a year because of these services that they provide ostensibly for free.
Well, yeah, that's the key word, huh? Because in an ecosystem of the commerce, someone is providing that service and they're not getting paid for it. So there's writers who have the many sentences that they provide online, which is then mined, like data mining, I suppose you could call it, to create the algorithm by which the automatic translation is done. So I think that's one of the complaints that people have about the whole supposedly free services is that someone is doing the work and they're not getting anything for it.
This is a very important issue. There's all this kind of radical transition that's going on, and the worry that some people are benefiting extremely while others are paying the price. And that's something that we have to be attentive to. We want to make sure that, you know, creators are properly compensated. Now, the way that Google Translate is working, and you're very astute in your description of the algorithms that it's using, it looks for things that have been translated that are available in multiple languages. And this could be government documents often. So the European Union, the United Nations put out the same document in multiple languages. They will take these documents as data for their computers to analyze and draw patterns from. So an incredible amount of very interesting number crunching. And of course, this will also include the work of private individuals as well, who might be offering their documents in multiple languages. Of course, they have to be cognizant of copyright issues in the process. But one of the things I worry about is an obsession with copyright can lead people to a standstill. So let's think about Google generally. One of the things that Google does is it makes, in some sense, a copy of everything on the web. In the process of creating its databases that allow you to search the web,
mm-hmm.
it has to kind of technologically copy everything and in that so that it can understand it and process it. I put scare quotes around understand here, and so that could, in some countries, be illegal. In fact, in the United Kingdom, there was worry that search engines might be illegal. When Google and Yahoo began their operations in with respect to Japan, they kept their search servers offshore because processing what was on the Japanese web might be considered illegal in Japan.
Mm.
So this is how law can actually make or break how the internet functions. Luckily, we in the United States have this notion of fair use, where we think there's a lot of transformative stuff that the user is doing to the original work, and that's kind of incredible value added that the user is offering is sufficient to justify the users using it without asking permission.
Well, that brings up the issue of the difference in laws around the world, and I'm sure that was somewhat of an issue with the pre-internet global commerce in terms of objects and goods rather than services. But I think we could go into that in our next segment about, well, just how does the fact that the internet is borderless and it's all everywhere, how is that, is it possible to regulate it? Should it be regulated by individuals or individual states? Or is there a way of developing international law codes that almost everyone would accept? So let's go into those questions in our next segment, and we look forward to Professor Chander's responses to them.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Begin with an email, a phone call, a flyer in the mail, or perhaps a misleading website. Loan modification scams. They come in all shapes and sizes and under different names. Loan rescue firms, counseling services, mortgage consultants. Sometimes posing as a legitimate mortgage company willing to help you modify your loan and get caught up with your payments. But beware, these are highly trained con artists looking to steal your home. They often know who you are, where you live, and because it's public record, know if you are on the brink of foreclosure. You're not alone, however. The National Crime Prevention Council and U.S. Department of Justice have partnered to help homeowners identify and steer clear of these scam artists.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Protect your home and safeguard your finances. It only takes a little time to become informed. Start by finding a free legitimate housing counselor today.
Take the first step. Visit www.ncpc.org/mortgagefraud. That's ncpc.org/mortgagefraud. This message is from the National Crime Prevention Council and U.S. Department of Justice.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show and our visit with law professor and director of the California International Law Center at UC Davis, Professor Anupam Chander. So we were going to be discussing the whole issue of developing some kind of international law or standard which various countries could subscribe to in terms of international commerce through the borderless internet. So what are the developments in that direction?
Well, this is a great question, and it's really the fundamental question of my book. When I use the title, The Electronic Silk Road, My hope is to say, is to remind people how much of a kind of trading environment the internet has created. And so it's to kind of change the way that we look at the internet, that we understand a company like Google or Facebook, we see them as kind of global traders, mm-hmm. as opposed to just kind of Silicon Valley enterprises, a totally different breed. We see them as engaged in something classic, something historic, these international trade routes. And, of course, with respect to goods, as you mentioned, Dr. J, that we have had issues about different conflict of law across different jurisdictions. But we've had millennia of experience with resolving and figuring out how to deal with those conflicts.
Okay.
With respect to services, this is the first time that people can really provide services from the comfort of their own home or from an office that's 3,000 or 6,000 miles away from where it's being consumed. And so this is a new world that we are just starting to walk into. Services have historically been provided on a very local basis. They are therefore regulated on a very local basis. Mm. And they haven't been subjected to kind of international competition. Now, this is a scary prospect. When you're subject to international competition for the first time, it's going to be highly disruptive. We saw the great transitions of the Industrial Revolution, which allowed for the localization of production of industrial products and kind of global trading routes that then spread those products, just much as the Silk Roads spread the products of China through the world and of the rest of the world to China.
I've been dying to ask this question for years. I was in a conversation with Julius Akinyemi. He was, I don't know if he still is, but he was at MIT, the Media Lab, Entrepreneur in Residence. Here's my dream. My dream, and the question is about that. What I want to do is see, based on your experience, and even if we're talking theoretically at the moment, what are the chances of me connecting with someone in one of the poorest or the poorest places in the world? Let's say I could make contact either on the phone, email, or whatever. And let's say that their currency is completely different than ours. Okay, this could be Africa, it could be Switzerland, it could be it's not going to be Switzerland, but anywhere, very poor. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to make a deal with them that if they sell one of our shirts with our show's name on it, advertising for us, I could pay them in the equivalent of American currency. Is that possible, or am I disrupting something that's going to come back to haunt me?
I think it's clearly possible, but you're talking about a global infrastructure here, an infrastructure of payments, and in many countries, payments, which we're kind of accustomed to, payments conducted electronically, for example, are routine, and you can imagine a kind of e-commerce transaction that takes place in the United States routinely. In a place like Indonesia, people are still quite reluctant to just buy something online. Instead, what they do is they use the online medium to arrange a physical meeting where the buyer and the seller actually exchange the good. So I learned all this when I was in Indonesia this spring. And so all these kinds of payment infrastructures, infrastructure of actually of transactions, differs across the world. The cultural norms and the legal customs also differ across the world. So I think that we can't presume that everything occurs just like it does in the United States. Now, what you are seeing in African countries, for example, is the great rise in mobile payments. So you actually see in Africa and Asia a world of payments that's actually significantly more advanced than the United States. So people can pay each other with their cell phones, which we really can't do in the United States. There are some services that do this. I don't want to promote any one in particular here, but there are some services that do in the United States, but it's still at the starting, in the early stages of those kinds of services. But clearly that's the world that we're coming to, where people can collaborate. You know, your designer for your T-shirt could be based in Belgium. Your manufacturer could be based in Jamaica or Bangladesh, and your consumers could be everywhere.
Wow, that's hope.
And the important thing for us to think about is that, you know, as the world gets richer, that means that everyone benefits. So the great thing about Adam Smith, who is kind of the guru of modern capitalism, mm-hmm. And he recognized that that trade is better for everyone. So there are many people in the United States or elsewhere who would like to say, only buy things that are just American. But imagine the whole world saying that. So we'll only buy things that are Canadian. The Canadians say, the Chinese will only say, we'll only buy things that are Chinese, etc. Well, that's a way to impoverish the world. And so we have to realize that we live in a global world. When the Canadians do better, we do better because we have greater markets. When the Chinese do better because we have greater markets. And when they sell goods to us and we sell goods to them, it makes the world a better place. And it helps, create a more prosperous world is ultimately a more peaceful world as well.
Thank you.
That's an interesting thought. I know that, you know, if you look through the beginnings of civilization, a lot of it had to do with gathering people together to where there was a critical mass of enough people to where labor could be divided and arts could be developed and so forth. I wonder if on a sort of a different tack, the impact of 3D printing as that develops, there it would seem like that would decrease the trade in goods, physical objects, even more. Do you see that as being something on the horizon for international trade that may really be also very disruptive?
It is definitely going to be a great new innovation, and I think that 3D printing is going to be a wave of lead to a wave of bespoke manufacturing. But I'm not of the opinion that this is going to end international trade in goods, or mm-hmm. that it's going to end mass production. You know, if you've ever purchased things in large quantities, it's becomes readily apparent that that big manufacturers of these goods are so much more efficient at producing those goods than any small manufacturer could ever hope to be. So we just bought some business cards for a campaign that I'm working on, for a local campaign, a local school board campaign. And we bought it from a company, not in town. We bought mm-hmm. lots of stuff from companies in town as well, but the business cards were so much cheaper by this very large manufacturer, which could easily, I actually don't even know where it's based, but it could easily be in Nevada, for mm-hmm. example. So it's hard to imagine replacing. So there are goods that we want totally specialized for us, mm-hmm. but there are also a lot of goods that I just want to buy off the shelf. That make more sense to mass produce as opposed to produce on a single off basis. I'm sure that manufacturers of 3D printers, for example, do not believe that they will be replaced by the 3D printers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Thank you for that. That's really good. So there's actually hope of doing business even maybe on a smaller scale across the world.
Yes.
You know, I mean the thing I'm leveraging, I think, is pretty obvious in my question, which is again a dream of mine, is that like making a $2 profit in this country could mean a lot more money if in a poor country they could get the equivalent. In other words, the equivalent of me mailing two U.S. dollars there, you know, if they could actually get the equivalent in their currency, you know.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's these kind, the access to become a global supplier of services has such transformative effects around the world, where people can now supply services from Africa or from poor parts of Asia or Latin America to the richer parts of the world. It incentivizes an investment in human capital. So you have to, in order to do this, by the way, you have to be literate. You have to be numerate. You have to have some facility with technology. So all these things kind of incentivize people going to school and coming to Dr. J's classes and learning, so they then be prepared for a kind of global world of providing services. And this is exciting. It's also challenging. You don't have as much the shelter of your local monopoly position, mm-hmm. which history provided you because of, you know, the difficulty of transacting services over long distances.
Well, thank you, Professor Chander. I have to say that this is an encouraging, optimistic conversation.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
It's an encouraging book. It's only $20 on Amazon, for example, in the hardback, and $15 in the electronic edition, of course.
Okay, and I have to say too, for our listeners, that it's easy to understand. You aren't writing for other law professors or researchers, so we appreciate that.
Thanks very much, Jay and Jim. I really appreciate that opportunity to have this conversation with you and great questions.
Thank you. And thank you for keeping us company today on the Social Network Show, where you hear commentary and analysis of our connected, networked world, including practical advice from top business and marketing mentors, news from people combating cyberbullying and abuse, as well as experts on privacy, surveillance, policy, women and girls empowerment online. Please follow us on Twitter at @SocialNetShow and listen to the show on the go at iTunes. Please have fun and be safe online and off until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.